welcome to Building the Game, a documentary podcast. Today's Monday, October 21st, 2013. You're listening to episode 73. Well, that was weird, wasn't it?
What
was
just happening?
I don't know. It was just something just broke inside me, I think.
I feel like was I making a face or something? I wasn't even looking.
You weren't
at
even
you.
Looking.
I had my hands over my face.
Something just I don't know. I think probably it's my back. By the way, hi, I'm Rob. That's Jason.
Hey! Continuing.
I hurt my back. We went to a wedding last weekend.
Yep.
Yeah,
back.
I've told you all this before, but let's pretend that I haven't told you because I need to listen.
Oh, okay. I'll act surprised.
Yeah. So we went to this wedding over the weekend, and I had way too much wine because it was free, you know? I think if you're going to have a wedding, you need to have at least free beer and wine for your guests. You don't have to have a full open bar.
To help them have fun.
Yeah. Yeah. Because Rob, the Rob that you're looking at right now, the sober Rob, who is sitting here having a conversation with you, would never dance in a million years. But you put a bottle of wine in Rob, I will bust a move. Okay? I will get down. I will pick up my wife and spin her around and hurt myself because that's exactly what I did.
Yep.
I don't remember it happening because I was that drunk, but oh man.
Here's the thing.
Yeah. Real pain here.
Sober. You don't like dancing.
Hate it.
You can't swing dance.
Nope.
Drunk. You enjoy dancing.
Uh-huh.
Still can't swing.
No. It's true. It doesn't make me a better dancer. It just lowers the barrier to entry for me.
Right.
Of personal dignity, you know.
For me, it's
self-worth.
For me, it just like is, I don't know. Like I don't mind dancing. I can dance completely sober, but
mm-hmm. I cannot.
Drinking a little helps. Kind of gets rid of the people like, are people watching me be a terrible dancer?
Drinking a little does not help me. Drinking a lot.
See,
is that
I think what helped me was
me.
In college, we'd go to places to dance, and I had a couple friends that were just like the worst dance. Like, have you ever seen Seinfeld? Like, Elaine was like they dance like that, but like dudes.
Yeah.
So as long as they were around, that kind of built my confidence because I'm like, I mean, I look like Michael Jackson compared to them. So, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So I can't dance. And I will not ever dance again unless I'm full of wine at a wedding.
Well, I mean, guilty feet have got no rhythm, so.
Right. Yeah, so, I'm in a lot of pain. That's probably why I messed up the intro. How are you?
Oh, I'm wonderful.
Good.
Wunderbar, as
Wunderbar?
They say that in Germany.
Yeah, I think they say it with the proper accent, though.
Which is?
I can't do a German accent.
Yeah. The only German I know is from the show Grimm, so, which I'm pretty sure is all fake German.
Probably.
Yeah. Wunderbar. That's not German.
This is an exciting conversation we're having here.
Guten Tag.
Guten Tag. You know what? All the German I know is from playing Wolfenstein 3D. Achtung. Verboten. Schusstoffel.
Schusstoffel. Schusstoffel.
That's all I know.
Wow. That's awesome.
Aye! And when the guy dies, goes, aye! Do you remember that?
No.
No?
I played that game very little.
Right. You missed out.
I know.
Yeah.
So I'm told.
Aye! What's new? What you been playing? That's the question I was trying to come up with.
What you
been playing?
So I haven't had a ton of time with my wife to play board games, so mostly I've just been playing some PS3 stuff later at night. But there's a game I wanted to bring up. First of all, I played Mirror's Edge. Well, we talked about me playing Saints Row, and we talked about open world. I played the game Mirror's Edge recently, and that game is fantastic.
Oh,
it's
so
basically
good.
A game about parkour, or free running, as they call it. And it's just, it's first person, and it's just so different. You're terrible at combat in the game, which is like, that's how it's designed. Your character is not good at fighting.
Yeah.
And you're advised when you see the cops, or the blue, as they call them, to run away.
Yep.
Because otherwise you'll die. And they're completely right about that.
Yeah,
so,
they sure are.
So many times, you just have to run away. But it's a lot of fun. It's almost perfect. There's a few errors, but you know, like a few things I think could make it better. But I'm not going to get into that.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, I'm going to complain about another game.
Okay.
So I'm playing the game I Am Alive, which I was telling you I really wanted a survival game that was gritty and felt real. And
and
you suggested you'd heard about I Am Alive. So I watched the trailer.
I never played it.
Right. But you'd seen stuff about it. I watched the trailer. I was sold.
Mm-hmm.
Downloaded the game. It's really cool. it's unique in the play style. You can't jump, right? You can only jump when it's applicable. So, like, if I'm trying to run and jump over something, I can jump. But, you know...
So, it's not a platformer.
Right, exactly. Yeah. It's 3D, of course, but a couple letdowns with it. One, it involves a lot of climbing. Like Uncharted-style
Uncharted
climbing.
Tomb Raider-style climbing.
Uncharted and Tomb Raider does it way better, though. So, for this, it's kind of like, why am I climbing? You know what I mean? The nice thing is it's super forgiving with the climbing because, with the walking, like, on ledges and stuff, because you can't fall, right? But when you climb, it's got this stamina bar. Because the idea is you can only climb for so long, and you're losing energy, and at a certain point, it gets too much to hold on, and you'll fall and die. Mm-hmm. Which is clever, right? I give them credit for that. The problem is the controls are kind of fidgety. So when you're in a hurry, like, you'll climb past the spot you need. Because, you know, with those what do they call those directional controllers on the two toggle button things? What do they call those on the PlayStation
3? The two toggle button things?
The ones you use to walk all the time in games. The left one's usually to walk, the right one's usually to heads up.
The sticks?
The sticks, okay, yeah. The joysticks, okay.
Yeah.
Last time I played a game, there was a D-pad, okay? So anyways, or I was using WADs. But, so anyways, the joysticks, right? Using those, it's just a little fidgety, and that's too bad. But here's the thing that really just grates me about this game. Mm-hmm. They have this system called retries, right? You get X number of retries. You can earn more in the game, but they're not super common, right? You might have five is the max, actually. I was reading about it. Five is the max. And what's really frustrating about it is you have five retries. Now, you can just die in some spots real easy. Like, they give you these grappling hooks so you can swing over stuff. But that negates the rules of I can't accidentally fall off the pit, like, into death. So I did it five times in a row, just trying to figure out how to use it correctly, right? So then when you're out of retries, it makes you go to, quote, the last saved point. Now, you can't choose when to save. It only saves you in certain spots in the story, right?
Hmm.
That could be 20 to 30 minutes back in the game.
Oh, that's not okay.
So I get that you're trying to do something unique, but tell me what the fun is in that. Like, I don't see the fun in that.
No, that's not okay.
So in a game that's not real forgiving with some of the stuff, and the fighting system is really cool, but really difficult. Like, you never have bullets. You'll get, like, one bullet, and then you'll almost immediately shoot someone with it, because they'll send gangs of people after you, and you'll have to. Because there's no quick fighting in the game. So it's just a little frustrating. Like, I wish I could see inside the minds of the designers to know why they made such a terrible decision. Because, like, right now I haven't played the game in a couple of days because I'm annoyed because I have to go through a section of the game that I didn't even enjoy the first time.
Yeah. You gotta
redo
it all.
To get to where I have to go, knowing that I'm probably going to die there again because the controls are wonky. So, and I have it set on the easiest mode. And so it's just a little frustrating because the game is really good. The story's great. And I'm not even a big story guy when it comes to video games. And I feel like the story is great.
Mm-hmm.
But man, it's just really frustrating.
It sucks.
So anyways, I mean, okay. I'll keep playing it.
Yeah.
I may never beat it because I may just keep getting reset.
Might get sick of it.
You know? So
yeah, there's some games that I have that are that way that I really like the concept of the game, and I really like the way it plays, but you hit a wall with some games sometimes where the difficulty ramps up, and it's just, and the game is good, but not good enough for me to power through that ramp up. Yeah.
You know, the difference is a game like Mirror's Edge, I would die in the same spot 30 times.
Yeah.
And I would start to get annoyed, but never as annoyed as because I got when that happened.
It rolls you right back into it.
Right.
It's just the exhilaration of it. And it even when you die, the game reloads fast enough that you kind of keep the excitement, keep the momentum going in your mind, so you want to keep going over and over and over.
Yeah, there was only one spot in that game where there's a cutscene. It's like a 15-second cutscene, and when you die, you have to watch it over again, and that was annoying.
I think is that when you try and kill that dude?
Yeah. And you're like, I'm hitting the button, why isn't it working?
Yeah, that was
I actually got online and Googled that. Like,
did you?
How do you kill this guy? And it's like, hit this button. I'm like, but I'm hitting this button. Yeah. And like other people were saying the same thing, like, you're hitting it the wrong time. You have to hit it at the right time.
Yeah, so I know exactly what you're talking about.
I did it the next try after okay, that works.
Yeah.
So you start doubting yourself. What am I doing? And then you're watching the stupid cutscene. But other than that, sometimes it would send you just a little ways back.
Mm-hmm.
But I always felt like, it's just practice. Like, I'm just getting to practice being better at this parkour stuff with this game.
Yeah.
And that helped later in the game. So that's how it's done. That's how it's not done between those two games.
Right.
So
right. Yeah, well, that's too bad. I'm sorry that it's not a better game, but it was like $15.
Yeah, it's $14.99. So yeah. I mean, I I'll keep playing it. I'll keep getting my money's worth out of it. But
I hit that wall, that same wall of Tokyo Jungle. Like, I really love what that game does so much, and the way that game was played was totally unlike anything else. It had a lot of style, a lot of character, and a lot of humor in it, and the story that it was putting together was really strange and fun, but. But, you know, there's two halves of the game. There's the story mode, and then there's, like, the just kind of general open mission stuff. In story mode, you're learning the story, and you're using certain animals to accomplish certain tasks. And then the open mode, you're just, you know, building stats and things. But it got to a point in the story mode where the dog that I was running around as was not fast enough or something to complete the mission, and I kept running out of time. And it just... I hit that wall of it just being a little too frustrating for me to continue. And I just kind of I got out of the habit of getting home from work and turning it on because one day I was like, I just kind of sick. Let me take a break from that. And I just never got back to
right.
it.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep.
So
what have you been playing? Hopefully a board game.
Yeah. Well, I thought I would talk a little bit about Troll Cakes and about the all the playtesting that I've done and kind of some of the revisions that I've made. So the original idea of Troll Cakes is you have these six ingredients, and there are six of each ingredient in the game, and everybody gets three recipes. First person to bake all three recipes is the winner, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. If you flip over a knight, the knight attacks you. If you draw a knight, you can play that knight to attack someone else. If you pick up a princess, you can either use the princess to chase away a knight, or she can be used as a wild card, as a wild ingredient to fill any slot. Okay.
Right.
Your recipe has two. A recipe requires three ingredients. Two of the ingredients are defined. The third ingredient can be anything you want, except for a no.
Right.
Every recipe has one specific ingredient, one specific creature, critter, bug. Says absolutely none of these. So spiders and centipedes are okay. The third one can be anything but a rat.
Right.
Okay. So after playtesting, I took that down to only five ingredients from six because there was concern with there being so many ingredients, it was difficult to actually get all the ingredients that you needed.
Right. And that happened in the initial playtest. That kept happening to me over and over again.
Right. So pulling that back to five, that cleaned that up a lot. And that I'm really happy with how that was moving now. After talking with Jason Katarski about it at Grand Con, he had got me thinking about the idea of suits in card games.
Yep.
You know, hearts, spades, diamonds, clubs. So thinking about that in terms of just adding one simple extra detail to all the cards in the form of a suit adds another layer of strategy, can add, depending on how you use it, another layer of strategy. So pulling it down to only five ingredients, I felt like maybe I was missing something. So what I did is I added three suits. And the suits are textures.
Right.
So juicy, crunchy, and savory. So I took down the five ingredients. Our five ingredients are centipedes, spiders, beetles, earwigs, and ants.
Right.
Okay. And there are six of each type. Two of each type are juicy. Two of each type are crunchy. And two of each type are savory. And now we also have two different types of recipes. We have easy recipes and hard recipes. Easy recipes require three ingredients. Two of those ingredients are specific named critters. The third ingredient is a specific suit.
Okay. Right.
So for my Troll House cookies, I need spiders, I need beetles, and I need something savory.
And then you don't need earwigs. Like earwigs are no.
Exactly.
So if you had a savory earwig, you could not use it.
I could not use it, right. And if I have a savory spider, he can either fill the spider slot or the savory spot, but not both.
Cool, okay.
Okay, all right. And then so those are the easy ingredients, or easy recipes. The hard recipes require five ingredients.
Okay.
Okay.
But they're worth more points.
But they're worth more points, because they're worth 5 points instead of 3 points. I then took it from, it changed it, not the first person to cook three recipes, but the first person to get to 15 points.
Right. So you have some options of how to get there.
Exactly, right. Depending on what you want to do. So at any time, during the draw phase, you can either draw a card, an ingredient card from the table, or you can draw a new recipe card. Okay, so whichever way you want to do it. And then there was the question of what happens if you draw a knight, or if a knight attacks you and you don't have enough cards in your hand to kill him. Well, first thing I did is I took it down from three ingredients or three rocks to kill a knight down to two.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then I said, you have the option. If the knight attacks you, you can throw two rocks at him or discard two cards from your hand if you want to kill him, or you can just choose to let him attack you. And then you can take that knight card and you put him on your score pile. And at the end of the game, that knight counts as a minus two. Okay, and so that means if you don't have anything to throw at him, well, then you just have to take it, and that's, there's nothing you can do about
it. Or if you have that perfect combination to make a 5-point recipe,
you don't want
to
lose
and you need 2 points to win,
right? Then it's worth
take
it for
it.
You,
or even 3 points to win, yeah,
right, yeah. And now, if you get a princess, you can still use a princess to fend off an attacking knight, but you still cannot use a princess to get rid of a knight that's already attacked you because the damage on from his attack is done.
Right.
But by putting the next thing I did is we originally had 6 princesses and 6 knights in the game. I took both of those down to 4. Because with 6 of each in there, there were a lot of those guys in there, and they just kept popping up. Pulling it back to 4 meant that there was a little more strategy involved, a little more of a surprise when one of them would appear.
Yeah, because with 6, they appeared like nonstop. It was pretty much guaranteed every round a princess or a knight or both would appear.
Both. Right, exactly. If not multiples of each. Right. And so when you take the knight and he goes into your score pile, that means he's out of the deck.
Right.
You know, he attacked. He's done his duty for the kingdom and he's attacked a fearsome troll. And now he goes off to have his victory and damage is done. But that means he's not going to attack again. He's out of the game.
Right.
He's out of the game, which then helps to speed up the rest of the game. You're not going to have to keep on dealing with these knights. Which also was kind of a side benefit of that.
Yep.
So as it is right now, I think it's a 58 card deck total.
Okay.
It's moving real smoothly now, and I'm very, very happy with progress on that.
Now, did you end up? We had talked about you imposing a strict hand limit.
Yeah.
And if you went over, you had to lay the cards out. I'm just curious if you used that. That was something we talked about.
Right. And that is the last unknown as to what the hand limit should be, because there needs to be some kind of a hand limit.
Right.
My original thought was 10 cards, but I think 10 cards is too many. I'm trying to decide now if I should make it 6 or 7 or 8 cards. I don't know. So that's the last thing that needs to get tested is what that hand limit is.
Cool.
But what that means is, I mean, that's an easy thing to test and just make a decision on depending on how it works. I can move forward now in making a better prototype. Cause again, the goal of this is to get it into the Game Crafter contest.
Right.
So I think I'm going to start kind of trying to put something a little nicer together for that.
Cool.
So that's really exciting.
Cool.
Yeah. So Troll Cakes, been doing a lot of testing on that. I keep calling it Troll Cakes. That's a terrible name, but I'm not really sure what else to call it right now because I'm still worried about Troll House Cookies being too fidgety, a little too...
Yeah, I get you.
Gosh, such a good name, though.
It is.
Yeah. So that's what I've been playing. I thought I might also mention some news. Okay. Because Jason and I talked about this, and... I mean, we want to be upfront. We want to be communicative with you guys out there and tell you what's going on. And I feel bad that I didn't say this sooner on last week's show. It was kind of bothering me last week, so I apologize to you guys for that. And that's to talk about some communications that I've had with publishers.
Mm-hmm.
While we were at Grand Con, and I'm not going to name any names here because
of course not.
You know, I don't need to do that. But while we were at Grand Con, I was there mainly to show off Maelstrom and to get some playtesting done. But I also had Frankenstein's Legacy with me. And while we were sitting there, I just had it out because, I mean, it's a nice looking prototype. And I'm still very happy to play it with people, of course, and always looking for more feedback.
You did get a game of it in, didn't you?
No, I'm not getting it in.
Did
no,
you?
Uh-uh. Okay. But while we were there, I actually had a guy from a publisher stop by the table, and he had listened to the show. And he pointed to Frankenstein. He said, what's going on with that? And I said, oh, well, you know, not a whole lot. I mean, I've got a lot of playtesting done in Gen Con, but hadn't really gotten any bites. Nobody had been really terribly interested. And so I'm kind of just trying to make a decision on what to do moving forward. I mean, I learned a lot in the process of it. So, you know, I still really believe in the game, but not a whole lot of action. And he said, okay, well, you know, I'd like to take a look at it if you don't mind. And I said, yeah, of course, sure. So I gave him the prototype that I had with me, and he took it home, and he just got back to me the other day. And unfortunately, he said it didn't seem like it was going to be quite right for what he was looking for, but he did give me some good feedback. The first thing he said here was basically that that everybody he played it with and showed it to really thought that it was it made sense with the theme that, that you're trying to assemble this, this creature, assemble these parts together to build a monster. And that fit really well with the idea of the deck building. And it felt very natural for that. I really appreciated that, cause that was kind of one of the main goals of the game for that, for the assembly to make sense. He pointed out some problems with my rules that, that apparently I wrote them too quickly and did not proofread them very well. So shame on me for that.
Happens.
And some general design and format stuff, for the game board, for the workbenches, which was very well, well taken. Another comment he had though is that there wasn't much ramping up for the players. That he and the people he played it with felt like they were equally powered or evenly powered, or had even options throughout the, from the beginning to end of the game. And that was something that I'd never thought of before.
Yeah, but he's kind of right. Other than the fact you might have better fuses later in the game, but I wouldn't necessarily call that ramping up.
Yeah, that it's a point well taken, very, very well taken. And we don't need to get into this detailed discussion about this right now, but it's something that I'm going to start thinking more about. About that idea of the ramp up.
Well, because Dominion, obviously, turn 15 is way more productive generally than turn 5.
Absolutely. So, absolutely, yeah.
And that's not always the case with Frankenstein. Right. That's a really good point.
And I think what that means is that if I'm going to be serious about this, I need to go back to the drawing board with a lot of the card powers and really revisit those. And think about ways that those could work together.
Make them more useful.
Absolutely. So, yeah, that was excellent feedback and the kind of thing that I hadn't gotten from any playtesters yet. I mean, that's the kind of feedback you get from a publisher.
Right.
So
it is.
That's really exciting. And so I really appreciate his comments on that. And I think it's great. It's great. And then the other thing is that I had contacted another publisher about Maelstrom, kind of sent them my info sheet about that, and they were intrigued. And again, I'm not going to say who that was because I'm not sure that they would appreciate that. I don't know.
Right.
But they were interested and asked for a prototype, and so I sent off a prototype. So fingers crossed, we'll see how that goes. No idea when or if they'll ever respond, but it's exciting just to have that kind of thing happen. It's the first time I've been asked to send somebody something. So. Yep. So that's really exciting. I'm really happy about that. If nothing comes from it, I need to see that as a learning opportunity to say, well, what can I learn from that result? You know?
Exactly. Right. Exactly. So I mean, along those same lines, I sent out one of my games to a publisher. I don't have any information yet, but it was, I guess I can say the game. It was Sandbox Showdown, which is no secret. I've been trying to shop that around for a while now. So, yeah. And after kind of getting the feedback at GrandCon, I was like, I gotta do something with this thing. So I sent it out, and they responded. They're looking at it now. So I know they've got it, and I know they're looking at it. It's exciting, and it's also kind of like, oh, gosh, at the same time, right?
Yeah.
You're just not sure, and you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's nice. Like, it's got to be harder for a game like Maelstrom, right? Because like, you're still like, I mean, like Maelstrom is so fresh for you, and like, so for it to actually be like getting out, like, and people wanting to see it, that's awesome. You know, like where the Frankensteins or a Sandbox, we've had those for a while. You know, so it's kind of like, oh, sweet, somebody still wants to see that. That's cool. You know,
because I mean, for Frankenstein, I still really like the game a lot, but it's just been a long time.
Right.
I mean, it's been several months since I was really actively doing development work on it.
Right.
Because as I was starting to kind of close up or get Frankenstein nailed down, the whole Rocket Wreckers contest thing exploded.
Right.
And I had to scramble and get Frankenstein put to bed to some degree.
Right.
And so that I could get Rocket Wreckers working well enough. So that I could really show it, and still no idea when that's going to air. Any of that the reality series, no word from Cards Against Humanity on that. But anyway, so then I got all ramped up on Rocket Wreckers, and then really got burned out on Rocket Wreckers from all that excitement, all that stress. And then Maelstrom was the first thing that hit me after that, and it is still kind of very exciting and very. I'm still really enthusiastic about this game. So for something to happen. To get some interest about that on something that's so fresh for me was really fun.
And it's cool to have something settle, you know, like with Frankensteins and Sandbox. We've kind of settled with those, like, all right, we've got something, you know, we're happy with.
Mm-hmm.
let's see if somebody's interested, you know? And mm-hmm. like, you know, with Maelstrom, like you said, it's just so like fresh to get something that fresh to a publisher doesn't happen to us very often.
No,
or
right.
ever.
Right.
So,
especially for something that I put together after Gen Con.
Right.
You know?
Exactly.
Yeah.
But as we said before, when it clicks, it clicks.
Yeah. Right.
So,
right. So sometimes, well, you know, we'll see. Fingers crossed.
We'll keep you guys updated. I mean, even right. if we get rejections and we have to not give any info, we'll still do that because yeah. why not? So,
right. Yeah, so that's what's going on with that. Shall we move on to our feature of the week?
Yes, let's do that. Mm-hmm. So, hey, the last few times, so we switched this, it was kind of, we were laughing, we switched this over to be the feature of the week, and mm-hmm. then, of course, all we did was talk about game mechanics, it felt like, so, which is funny, because when we had it to be game mechanics, we kind of meandered, so, but this time we actually have something a little different to talk about. Rob and I have been getting a lot of feedback lately, on our games. Great feedback. You know what I mean? Like, everybody gives good feedback. Even people who give, you know, even Cape Guy at Gen Con,
yeah.
who plays your game totally wrong and breaks it in a way that no one should ever break it, still is giving good feedback by doing that because, you know, but, you know, something that's been bothering me lately, because I've seen it happen a few times, to me and to you, I think there's two broad ways to give feedback. Right? And that is the feedback you're giving is your opinion, or that is the feedback you're giving is fact. And I want to talk a little bit about that in feedback in general, but I really want to point that out because that was kind of the impetus of you and I to say, let's talk about this on the show. Let's try and hash this out. And we purposely didn't talk about it much ahead of time. I mean, I just kind of said, I want to bring this up. Recently, I've had a couple different people give feedback, and they've really given what I would call the fact feedback. And the feedback they're giving are not facts, necessarily, but they're presented as facts. To the point where they're saying, you must do this. Your game has to have this. These aren't publishers. You know, and even if it's a publisher, I would caution them to say, your game has to have this if you want me to publish it, right?
Well, in that case, that would be a fact, yeah.
Well, but see, that is a fact, right? Because there's a qualifier on that.
Right.
But when somebody just says, your game has to have this, other mm-hmm. than your game has to have mechanics, you know, like, it can be tough to kind of receive that feedback sometimes. Because even if it's good feedback, it's still frustrating. Mm-hmm. Because as much as we need to be humble when we receive feedback, right? People should be humble when they give feedback, you know, and that's a lesson to us too. I mean, you know, I always, whenever I give feedback, you know, you always try and present your opinion as such, right? Your opinion. You know, even if like, you know, I've played some of your games, you play some of mine where I look at your game and I'm like, this piece of feedback I'm giving you will make your game better, right? And you've said the same thing to me with mine. Like, it will, like, that is a fact. Your game will be better with it, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's still your opinion, you know, and that's, so yeah.
So what you're saying here is that you think that if you're going to play test a game, you need to not be a jerk to the guy who made the game.
I guess that's one way to say it, but I mean there are multiple ways you could be a jerk to the person, right? I mean, like, if I play test someone's game and, you know, like, you know, I felt like a jerk a couple times when people have tried to pitch stuff to me, like, not like all like fans of the show or someone who come to me like, hey, I've got this game I want to, because that I'm always excited about, right?
Yeah.
Because you're trying to do the same thing we are. I remember though, in Grand Con, actually, I was at a booth and these people have no idea who we are and I won't mention who they are, so it doesn't matter. But you know, as I walked past the guy's booth, he said, hey, do you like these kind of games? And I kind of looked at what he had and I could see that he was promoting something and I knew I wasn't interested. But I was like, you know what? I said, give me your elevator pitch. And I immediately felt like a jerk for saying that. Because, like, I hate when people say that to me. Even though, like, that's what people should say to each other, right? Like, hey, listen, like, let me give you the elevator pitch because I don't want to waste your time, right? And now I'm kind of wandering off on another subject. But I guess, so the feeling like a jerk thing, right? Like, it's not just about not being a jerk. I mean, everybody should be respectful when they're giving feedback, right? Because, you know, you have to remember that a game designer is kind of opening themselves up to you, right? When they let you play their game. And for newer designers, that can be tough. I feel pretty hardened to it at this point. I don't know about you, but like when the person presents all of their ideas as fact to me about things that are broken with my game, that doesn't hurt my feelings. It doesn't make me feel bad. It just kind of makes me think they're being a jerk. So maybe you're right with that. You know, so yeah, I guess I don't know. I mean, I feel like there's more of a discussion here, but I'm kind of falling short of it.
Well, so we're talking about we're talking about how we present feedback, how you communicate. We're talking about communication, right? That's what we're talking about. Talking about how we communicate our opinions to the designer.
Right.
And how we as designers would like our playtesters to communicate their opinions to us.
Right.
So we're designers here, right? So if we're gonna say to a Hollywood does screen tests of their big time summer blockbuster movies, right?
Right.
And they want feedback. They want very specific feedback in very specific ways from the people who they're testing that movie on. So what do? They give them a sheet of paper with checkboxes.
Yep.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And they don't care about your personal opinions and nuance, and they don't want you to write an essay. They want you to check yes or no, or scale a 1 to 5, that kind of stuff.
Right.
Because that's stuff that they can feed into a computer in mass and just deal with,
yep.
You know, and draw aggregate conclusions about that. Okay. So we as designers, if we're going to ask people for feedback, would we like concise analytical data like that? Or would we prefer feeling and nuance and ums and ahs and you knows and really kind of made me think about, I mean, what is more useful to you?
I want the nuance only because that raw data doesn't tell me anything. If some if the question is, would you want to play this game again? And the answer is no. And that's the only information I get from you. I want to know why. I want to know if, hey, this isn't my type of game. Like, hey, this is a fun game, but I don't like deck building games, or I don't like strategy games, right? You know, or I only play party games. Awesome. Good to know. Like, because that doesn't make your feedback less valid.
Mm-hmm.
It just makes your feedback different, right? Like if, you know, I had had that kind of strategy fighting game, warish game that we were playing, the Fortress game that I pitched on the show. And you are not a fan of that style of games. And you still gave me excellent feedback, but it was different than if I'd played it with one of my friends who's really into those type of strategic games.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to give different feedback than you're going to give, but it's still equally valid. So I think the nuance, I mean, I don't know how you feel, but I feel like the nuance is really important. Also, kind of to pull a Steve Jobs quote here, and I'm paraphrasing, but, you know, he basically said the customer doesn't know what they want until you tell them what they want, right? Which is kind of a pompous thing to say, but
sure is.
The first part of the customer doesn't know what they want is absolutely true, right? So like, if you just say to somebody, like, why don't you like my game, or what do you like about the game? They don't necessarily, they can't necessarily just say, like for instance, if they just have to say yes, no, it's good, it's bad, whatever, they might say it's bad, or they might say it's good, right? Like, they might be like, your game is super fun. But then you delve more and you find out that the game that they're playing is super fun to them, but other people are going to hate that about the game. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Or the game really, like, for instance, on the last episode, we talked about Quicksilver and how you were, like, way behind. Like, in a playtest, somebody would be like, I hate this game because of this.
Yeah.
But you know that their experience in the game isn't normal. You know what I mean? So,
I think what we're getting to here is we're getting to how we as designers should be asking for feedback.
Yeah.
Because when we say to somebody who's just played our game, when we say, what'd you think? They say, yeah, that was great. Or they say, yeah, that sucked. Or they say, yeah, no, it was all right. Yeah. Whatever that initial response is, I mean, that's some kind of information, but we're not going to learn anything in detail from that until we ask the right questions about how they arrived at that feeling,
right.
that reaction.
And I think there's like, a lot of people don't want to make you feel bad. Like, if they don't like your game, they don't want to say, I didn't like this. But I don't mind when somebody plays a game and says they don't like it. Because
no, I don't mind either. I'm happy to know that.
They're going to have constructive feedback, hopefully. I mean, they have the ability to have constructive feedback. Whether or not they're actually going to give you that feedback, you don't know. If they tell you they don't like it, I think there's a better chance than if they say, this was pretty fun. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, and I know that when you and I used to give each other feedback, we'd start out there, we're like, oh, this is a pretty fun game, you know? But, like, we rarely just say that to each other anymore, you know?
Right.
I mean, like, we'll use things like, you've got a game here. Like, there's a game in here somewhere. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
You don't have it yet, But there's a game in here, and this is what I liked about it, and this is what I didn't like about it.
Yeah.
And I think comfort helps with that. So that's why I'm always baffled by those people that aren't worried about the comfort. Like, they're just willing to just unload their thoughts about, you know, all the facts about your game that necessarily aren't facts, you know. And I want to point out, I mean, I sound like I'm, like, jaded about this. I want to reiterate that, like, there's no hurt feelings here. It's just frustrating because it feels kind of pompous, and that's something I really don't like.
There's always going to be a jerk out there. There's always going to be a jerk that thinks that he or she is, you know, knows it all.
So I guess my best advice to other designers who get that jerk giving them feedback, listen to their feedback. Because even though they're a jerk, it doesn't mean their feedback's not great.
There you go.
Because we've learned that. I mean, we've gotten feedback from people, and the person's not necessarily a jerk. They just present their feedback in a really crappy, negative way, even though they like your game. And that's, you know, like, I mean, I had somebody a while back try one of my games, and he got done with it. He told me all the terrible things wrong with it, and then said, if you were selling this right now, I'd buy it.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow. You know, so it just shows that just because somebody gives you a bunch of negative feedback doesn't mean they don't like your game. Mm-hmm. And doesn't mean they don't find it fun. You know, I once had a guy say to me, this is the Gen Con, he tried it. And this guy wasn't a jerk or anything. I mean, he just said, when he got done, he said, I'm trying to think if I'd want to play this again. I mean, I don't hate your game, but I don't know that I'd want to play it again. But I'm not sure why. I thought, well, that's kind of interesting feedback. It's basically non-feedback, right?
Yeah.
You know, and I think if you're giving feedback, you need to make sure to give honest feedback, but give real feedback, right? Like, first of all, telling someone you like a game when you don't, or telling somebody it's a good game and you don't, is like, I would liken it to this. It's like telling your friend who says they're going to try out for American Idol, who really can't sing, that they should do it. If you're going to be awesome, you should do it. Because then they're going to be on TV and they're going to get embarrassed in front of everyone because they're like the world's worst singer. That can happen to us too. If everybody keeps saying your game is so fun, and then you put it in front of a publisher and they're like, dude, this is crap. Mm-hmm. That sucks, right? Because you had all those chances to get good feedback, and instead you just got, you know,
you got served.
It's just fun. You got served. Nice. So I think, I mean, I think the thing to remember is...
Yeah, so if somebody's listening... I'm sorry, go ahead, I cut you off.
I would say that I think the thing to remember is this, that you need to make sure to give lots of open feedback.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't know, like, if you say, I think this is wrong with the game, but I don't know how to tell you to fix it, that's okay. You and I do that to each other all the time, where I'll be like, I feel like this mechanic's not good, but I don't have any good ideas on what to tell you.
So for the two people who are listening to this... For the two types of people, for the people coming out from the player, the tester perspective, and from the designer perspective, for the person doing the testing, we would ask you as designers, we would say, don't hold back, give us all of your feelings, but if you could try and give us specific information to go along with those feelings, that is extra helpful to us.
Right.
If you could start with your big picture saying, I like this, it makes me feel I enjoyed, I didn't enjoy, and then if you can give us specific examples of it, that's helpful. But I think the more important thing for us to say is to the designers to say, you can't guarantee that you're going to get the perfect tester every time.
Right.
So you need to be ready to ask questions and ask specific questions to try and help them drill down to what they specifically liked, didn't like, what worked for them, what didn't work, what excited them, what bored them. You need to know your game inside and out, and hopefully you do because you designed it, and you need to be familiar with what's working and what's not. Hopefully you have areas of the game that you're not sure about or that you're looking for feedback on, and you need to ask people about those specific things so that you can get the feedback you need. And some people, when they're testing your game, will give you that without you even asking for it. But more often than not, you're probably going to have to drill down to it.
Right.
Yeah.
One other tip I would say as a designer is pay attention to people when they're playtesting. Watch them and try and really get down to what you think they're enjoying and what you think they're not enjoying. Because, as I said before, the customer doesn't always know what they want, right?
Yeah.
So they may be able to tell you what they liked about your game, but you'll notice that they actually had more fun in other parts of your game.
Yeah.
But that said, I've played enough games with Rob to know that a lot of times Rob just looks like he's really mad when he's playing a game. And then in the end of the game, we'll say, dude, this was awesome. I love this game.
Can't always read body language.
So you can't always. And I know Rob really well, but numerous times we played a game together and I just thought you were mad about the game. And you weren't. You were just thinking. Mm-hmm. Like, that's just kind of that mean look is kind of your normal face, I guess.
I'm an angry person. Real quick, because we're running long on this conversation here. One of the guys who tested Maelstrom with me at Grand Con, sometimes you just get people who just aren't interested in the game that you're asking them to play. And whatever. I mean, that's going to happen. That was Cape Guy. Okay, Cape Guy was not interested in playing the game that I put down in front of him. And oh well. I don't know why he didn't quit, but... Okay, so this guy, we were just playing a two-player game in Maelstrom, and I was going easy on him because I, at this point, had played this game 25 times.
And
you're
really good at it now.
And I was just like, because, you know, I'm not playing the game to win. I'm playing the game to just try things now, you know, because I need to do that. And he got wrapped up in his own personal tableau, his image, his display with his ship, where he's placing his workers, placing his crew on his ship, and at some point in the game, I said to him, you know what, man, if you put two guys there and then do this, you will kill me and you will win the game. He's like, I don't want to do that. I'm not interested in what's going on out there. I feel like this is the game that I want to be playing. And he points to the tableau with his workers on. He said, I feel like the game that you've got here, I think the better way to go with this is what's happening here is the guys on the deck of the ship. I think this is where you need to go with this. And that said to me, well, my first reaction was, then this is not for you.
Right.
Okay. That was really frustrating.
Right.
And I'm thinking, there are people walking by who are obviously interested in what's happening here. Can I get one of them instead?
Right.
But I had to stop myself, and I needed to say, okay, well, just you know, get over yourself. What is he saying? What do you need to hear from what he's saying? And so what I chose to hear from that is that he might be right. There might be a great game that involves your crew on the deck of your ship, and you're about swinging across to other people's ships and capturing their crew and holding them hostage. But that's not this game.
Right.
Yeah. So he got something in his brain about another game that might be a great game.
Right.
But that's not the game we were playing. So, no, I'm not sure where I'm going with that.
Well, to wrap this up, you kind of bring it right back to where I started with fact versus opinion.
Yeah.
He was telling you the facts. To him, the facts were, you have an awesome game if you just completely change it and do it completely different the way he wants the game to be.
Yeah.
And to that guy, I would say, design a game.
Because
you have a game in mind and you really like it, and you should make that game because his game sounded like it'd be fun, but it wasn't Maelstrom.
Right.
And remember to yourself as you're giving feedback, and I try and do this too, because there are times when somebody will show me a game, especially like a green designer, like who makes me feel experienced, right? Even though we still aren't that experienced. Right. And they show you their game and you're like, no, you're thinking, I know these three things will make your game 100 times better. And you present those things and they ignore them and they say, no, that's not what I'm looking to do. And you just have to humble yourself and say, you know what? It's not my game. You know, like, I had even actually to you with Maelstrom, and I'm glad you didn't take the advice, because it was not good advice for Maelstrom, but I had suggested a mechanic for you. I said, you should think about this mechanic to try and diversify things, and I won't get into the details, and you said, no, I don't think I'm going to. And I took that back and thought, you know, I think Rob's right. And I came back to you. What did I say? I said, I'm going to take that mechanic back because I think I can make that new again.
Right.
And I still haven't yet, but it's one of those things that I've been trying to think about, you know, that's how you need to be with that kind of feedback, because otherwise you're going to just end up being frustrated as a feedback giver that you're giving this amazing, you know, quote, amazing feedback, and they're just ignoring it because it might not be amazing feedback that fixed the game, you know?
Yeah.
So put a little button on that there.
There you go.
Ding.
Sparkles.
Hey, you should practice your pitch now.
I should practice my pitch.
Sorry, we're running a little long.
Right.
For a discussion that I felt like we were running out of steam, we seem to still go along with it.
Man, we're just getting overexcited here. It's a good news, though, because this should be a quick pitch. This is a real simple game that I've had bouncing around in my head here for a few weeks. I think I'm actually going to post something about it on the co-op website. It's kind of inspired me to start a new column, a kind of semi-regular column on the co-op, but more about that another time. The game is called Free Fall. Like, I was kind of thinking, the original inspiration was
Tom Petty.
No. was what happens after Rocket Wreckers. If somebody loses, or if the wrecker wins and both of those players have to bail out, now they're falling through the sky. What happens next? But that was dumb. But it led me to have you ever seen, what is it? Oh, the James Bond movie. I want to say Moonraker.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Point Break.
Well, Point Break is the other one. I think the original thought was, I think it's Moonraker. I don't know, one of the early Bond movies where James Bond I think it might be Jaws. Anyway, James Bond and another dude are jumping out of a plane. There's only one parachute. And so they're having a fist fight, beating each other up while falling out of the sky, trying to be the guy who gets the parachute on, pull the ripcord, and saves his life. And the other guy falls and splats on the ground.
Right.
Okay. I wanted to make a game about having a fist fight in midair to try and catch the parachute and survive and let the other guy hit the ground.
Right.
But you have a time limit. You have to do it before the deck runs out. Otherwise, you both hit the ground.
Which makes sense.
Which, yeah, right. And then after that, I realized, oh, man, that'd be cool, like Point Break style, too. But, you know, they both survive in that, you know, so.
Oh, yeah.
Right. Because later, Keanu finds Patrick Swayze on the beach in Australia, I think. Now I got to go watch Point Break again. So anyway, so here's the idea for Free Fall. It's a deck of cards. Okay. All right. The game begins with a full deck, and you're both drawing cards from the same deck. Okay. When the deck runs out, the game ends, and that means you hit the ground. Okay.
Curse splat.
There is a track on the table. It's a long straight track, and it's got 10 spaces on it. Okay. At the start of the game, each player has a token, like a little token with their portrait on it, right? Okay. Both players start with their tokens on one end of the track, and the parachute token is on the other end of the track. Okay. You are playing cards you take turns, and it's a play a card, draw a card game. You play one card, you draw another card. Okay. And I'm thinking you have 5 to 7 cards in your hand.
Okay.
All right. You play a card down, and that card is a plus or minus kind of thing. It allows you either to move your token, your opponent's token, or the parachute token. And moving them back and forth on this track. Okay. There is chaining abilities where, you know, if you have two cards in your hand that both have the same icon, that means you can chain together two moves, only up to 3 cards chained at any given turn, no more than that. It might be difficult to think. You're not always going to be able to do that. You might not always want to do that.
Okay. Right.
it's basically simple plus minus cards or no move cards or defense cards, this kind of thing, right? Real simple numbers, moving things up and down the track. At the end of your turn, if you end the turn with your token on the same space as the parachute token, then you get a grab card. You grabbed the chute. Okay. If at the end of your next turn you are still on the same space as the parachute, you get the buckle card. You buckle it on. Okay. If on the end of your third turn in a row you still are on the same space as the parachute, then you pull the ripcord and you win.
Okay.
Okay.
When I get the buckle card. Now I'm wearing it. Mm-hmm. If somebody does something to me, do I move back to the grab card?
No. If somebody does something to you, they rip it off and it just goes flying, and now it's all hands together. You can't like bank those stages, because if somebody rips it off, you got to grab it again, basically.
Okay. Yeah. Is it harder to rip it off if you're wearing it than if you just have a hold of it?
I'm not sure.
Feels like it should be.
It feels like it should be.
Doesn't it? I mean, if I have it buckled,
mm-hmm.
it should be harder to get it from me than if I'm just holding it.
Yeah, my original thought is just that's a, you know, a way to thematically count a number of turns while holding the thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that was kind of my original thought. But if you're right. I mean, if I'm going to apply those labels to it, it might make sense.
I would think maybe you could have a real simple, like, if to grab the parachute, like, you have to use a parachute move and chain a card to it, right?
Okay.
Or maybe to grab the parachute when no one else has it, you just have to play a card. But to get to that parachute when somebody's having it and to get it from them, you have to chain two cards. One has to be something that lets you get to the parachute. One has to be any other card that works in tandem with that, right?
Okay.
And maybe to get it unbuckled, you have to chain two cards to that top card. or something.
If you're unlucky with your card draws, though, I mean...
You're giving them seven cards. I mean, I personally feel like that's too many cards. But then again, with the way you're describing the game and how tough it might be to get the parachute, that might not be enough cards. I don't know, you know?
Yeah, I'm not sure. Yeah, I mean, it's still very conceptual right now, of course. Mm-hmm. So in order to successfully grab, successfully buckle, or successfully pull it away from somebody, you need to be able to chain two things together in order to do that.
What if on your turn, everybody starts with like three cards. On your turn, you always draw two cards. Maximum hand size of seven, right?
Okay.
But if you don't do anything, you draw three cards or something. Maybe you always draw one card. If you don't do anything, you draw two. Something so you can kind of like plan, right? You're just going to keep diving and you're watching the events unfold. And then you're going to be like, all right, chain, boom, I got the parachute. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. So you don't have to play a card on your turn, you're saying? Or
I was saying you could avoid playing a card on your turn, which would just mean that you are falling straight down. With no action.
Yeah, well, I guess that would make sense. You don't necessarily have to always do something.
Because if you're doing that, like, you could be kind of... The idea is you're kind of surmising the situation. You're watching what the other guy's doing so you can react to that. But once you come to seven and you can't draw anymore, there's no reason to just keep doing that, right?
Right.
Because
that stage, you're discarding one, getting a new one every time.
Now, can you change the elevation of your opponent?
Yeah, so that's the you can move your token, your opponent's token, or the parachute, and I think a lot of those things will have cards will have ranges on them. So you know, one of the cards might be punch. So you can punch your opponent, but only if you're on the same space or adjacent spaces. If he's two spaces away from you, you can't play that card.
Right.
Whereas you might also play, you know, a gust of wind that you can play that on somebody on any, you know, maybe that can be played on any of the tokens.
That would make sense.
You know, based on where
the multiple use out of the cards, which I know you're a fan of anyway.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So some move one specific token, some could be applied to any token, you know.
You know, another thing that might be fun too would be to have like cards like push off.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, you below someone, you like kick them so they go up, you go down.
Right.
Theoretically, or vice versa, depending on where the parachute is, you know.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You move in opposite directions.
Right.
And you said you can only chain up to three cards?
That's my original thought here.
See, and I would say that if you could do the whole thing, you should be able to chain as many as you want, because it's never going to be that great, right? The best case scenario is, on one turn, I'm going to push you way away, I'm going to go down, and I'm going to grab the parachute.
Mm-hmm.
Best case scenario, right?
Yeah.
So then on the next turn, you're going to have to work to get to me.
Yeah.
And I think that's cool, because that's my setup, right? Like,
right.
You know, you could be trying to get to the parachute, and I'm going to try and get you out of there. So...
Mm-hmm.
So, just a thought.
Yeah. Okay.
Plus, I haven't seen that really much before. It kind of makes it a little more dynamic gameplay, a little more strategic for just a simple deck of cards with a thing.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, I kind of like that. Yeah, I might have to...
It's a fact, Rob. That will make your game better.
Thanks.
If you don't do that, your game's going to be terrible.
It'll be terrible. You're right. You're probably right. I should just give up right now, honestly.
Yeah.
I should just stop trying.
No, I actually think it sounds really fun.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, just, you know, the whole, I mean, everybody knows that scene in movies where the two guys are free falling and there's only one chute and, oh no, who's going to get it?
Right.
Yeah. And you know, and should I have a gun? Maybe there should be a handgun in there. Or maybe each player has a handgun. They start the game with a gun card in their hand and they can shoot once because they each only have one round left in the gun. You can shoot once to cancel somebody else's card or something. You know, it seems like there should be, if it's going to be like really like a spy and a villain falling out of the plane, maybe there should be other spy gadgets or stuff, you know?
Yeah. I like the idea of a gun. I love the idea of one gun.
Yeah.
Because
maybe changing hands. Every time you use the gun, it goes to the other guy.
Well, or like if the gun was another token that was like falling.
Oh, so that's a good idea.
Maybe
you
when you
catch
get
the gun,
and if you get the gun and you shoot them, maybe they lose their next turn.
Maybe this is better. Maybe that's a better game. What if there's a bunch of stuff falling through the sky? And depending on which token is on which space, you can do different actions. So the cards just straight up move things. In this way, it's more like Phantom of the Opera.
Right. So all the items are in play at all times.
All times. And you need to be able to hold on to the parachute for three rounds. But if you can get the gun over to you, then you can shoot at the other opponent and knock the thing away.
And maybe like another card forces them to discard cards. Mm-hmm. Well, I would think that, like, if you have the gun, you shoot them, they lose a turn. If they have the parachute on, they lose the parachute. Well, actually, no, just make them lose a turn, right? Because that means you have a whole other turn to act, to mm-hmm. try to...
I don't like lose a turn. I think you can... The gun, you can shoot at them, and they can... It would make them drop whatever thing they're using on that turn they can't use.
That makes sense. That makes sense.
Yeah. So, and there, one of the tokens could just be a wind gust, you know? Which is push anything, a certain number of distance. Maybe the bird, if you end your turn on the thing with a bird, you have to dodge a bird, and so you don't get to do anything on this round.
Right. Well, that's losing your turn, which you said you didn't like. Devil's advocate.
Yeah.
It'd be great if you had... Maybe a bird makes you lose cards. So you're dodging a bird, so you're dropping cards.
Okay, that could be. Mm-hmm. So maybe, what other stuff could be floating through the air with you?
Fire extinguisher. You just propel yourself.
Like Wally?
Yeah. I love it. A tank. That would be funny to you if you've played Saints Row 3. Yeah. That crap actually happens.
Right.
Also, CDA team.
Right. Other spy gadgets of some kind. I don't know. The gun, though, is actually a pretty good idea.
Maybe a martini that's shaken, not starts, is falling. You can take a drink.
And draw an extra card, because you're so awesome.
I just picture these icons of what does a martini last with, like, three olives in it.
Yeah. That actually might make it a funnier game, come to think of it.
It just depends on what you're trying to think of. Yeah. Like, what you're trying to do. Like,
right.
The original game you were pitching was pretty serious.
Kind of serious, right. But
if you want it to be silly,
right.
If you're going to make it about spies, it has to be a martini. I mean, I don't want to say it has to, but I mean, come on, dude.
Yeah,
How great would that be?
It might be extra funny that way. All right. That's a whole perspective that hadn't occurred to me. That's funny. Maybe I'll play with that idea, too.
Because then, also, if it's going to be spy gadget, you got to have a laser.
Right, the laser watch of some kind.
Right.
Yeah. See, so many spy gadgets are about attacking, though, you know?
But you just have to make the attacks different. Like, say the laser, for instance. If you have the parachute, you lose the parachute if somebody uses the laser on you.
Because they cut the strap off you or something.
And you could hold, up to two items at a time. So you have two hands, right?
I guess.
Except for maybe some items are bulkier. Like, if you had one item that was, like, something else.
The rubber raft.
Yes, the rubber raft.
Yeah, the big inflatable rubber raft. That can, if you have the raft, you can deploy the raft and you can immediately shoot back up X number of squares.
Right. And then the raft just deflates at the end of the turn.
Right.
It starts falling again.
Right.
I love that. Rubber raft. What a great idea.
Huh.
What about a missile? What if there was a missile falling?
I don't know about a missile.
You could ride it.
Oh, like Slim Pickens.
Exactly.
Yeah, right. That was a bomb, though. That wasn't a missile.
Yeah, but like, remember True Lies? The guy gets shot with a missile.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. All right, that's not bad.
Rocket launcher.
Yeah, we could do that.
I think we're pretty over time.
I think we are. All right, that's enough. Anyway, the game's called Free Fall. These are the ideas that I've got right now. So,
I really want to play the game now. Okay. I wanted to play it before. Now I really want to play the game. I want to drink a martini at 3,000 feet.
Oh, man. I think drinking martinis while you're playing the game should be mandatory. Yeah. Or strongly encouraged.
Yeah.
Okay, then that is all we've got for today. Man, what a strange show. So thank you guys for listening to the show. We really appreciate it. If you want to get in touch with us, you can email us to buildingthegamepodcast@gmail.com. You can also contact us on Twitter at podcastbtg. Jason is at JASlingerland, and I am at poorly_designed. You can like us on Facebook, and you can give us 5-star reviews. Multiple is the thing there. Give us lots of 5-star reviews on iTunes,
lots
please.
Of them.
As many as you can. You can take a look at the BTG Co-op site. Don't forget about that, btgco-op.com. We've got lots of exciting stuff on there, including our bi-weekly Something From Nothing Google Hangout webcast video excitement extravaganza. Every other week, Jason and I, or one of us, will get together with some of our game design buddies and just talk about designs, talk about stuff we're working on, and share that with you. And we'll take questions from the Twitter land as we do that. And then, of course, those shows are always archived on YouTube. That is going to do it for us. And you guys have a wonderful, wonderful evening.
Good night.
Building the Game is a co-production of Imminent Entertainment and Poorly Designed Studios.
All the ideas presented by Rob and Jason are the property of the Building the Game podcast.
Next time on Building the Game. All right, here we go. Hello and welcome to Building the Game, a documentary podcast. Today is Monday, October 20th. I'm starting over that because that was bad.